I talked about a few minutes ago the circular reasoning of those who approach the resurrection. It could not occur, so it didn't occur. So anyone who reports that it did occur must be lying or deluded because it can't occur, going in a circle. The same is true when people approach Genesis, which means beginnings. The first word in our King James, four words, in the beginning, God. Two words in the Hebrew, Bereshith, Elohim. And Bereshith includes the root that is exclusively used of God that I wrote on the board last Sunday. There's the first word of Genesis, Bera, which is to create. If man is making something, or you are, even God, made man, Adam, from the dust of the earth, it's a different Hebrew word. Asa. Bera is used exclusively of God because you are bringing forth from nothing. Created out of nothingness, existing only in the mind of the Creator, and He brings it forth from not a thing. Doesn't rearrange anything. He's there, and then He creates, Bera. We don't want to believe that. There are lots of reasons, and I'll come to some of the reasons. I want to show you the circular reasoning that is in the minds of the modern man as he approaches Genesis. Circular reasoning. And I've got here laying in front of me 1, 2, 3, 4 major commentaries on the book of Genesis, and I could line them up across this platform. But I picked a few today I'm going to read from. Form criticism. If you get into commentaries, you read a lot about this. The oldest legends used to say that God appeared to Moses on Mount Sinai, and He told Moses how it all happened. And Moses wrote down what was told him on Mount Sinai. And we have the Torah, the first five books of the Bible. Then the critics began to dig in. And we have P and J and E and D. And they're dissecting these books until it's all a product of human hand, assembled out of legends that are germane to all societies. And as archaeology uncovered the myths of Babylon and Chaldea and other primitive societies, and it was noticed that there's common ingredients, doesn't matter where you go. Ancient American Indian legends, the legends of the ancient civilizations of South America, Egypt, Asia, wherever you go, common denominators crop out. A beginning, a fall and a devastation, a flood, a family that survives. So it is argued, this book of Genesis is but one among many assembling by human hands of legends that abound. And there were several editors, and some came into the book with Jehovah being the name of God, and others came into the book with El or Elohim being the name of God. And that requires two writers and two editors, because they all start out like this. Form criticism distinguishes poetry or poetic narrative from historical narrative. Now, this is Creation and Blessing. Pretty good writer. Alan P. Ross, The Guide to the Study and Exposition of Genesis. Form criticism assumes that poetic composition lies behind the stories in Genesis. Eichfeld distinguishes poetic narrative from historical narrative by listing the following features of poetic narrative. Myth. Now, this is, before you start reading, you make this decision. You remember what I told you about the Jesus seminar? Now, I can forgive a fool for being prejudiced, because ignorance produces that. But when you travel the road high in academic pursuits, there is one thing that is dinned into you: respect for truth. I think I've told you this story before. I wasn't supposed to see a letter written by one of my professors that's in the packet that is at Stanford placement office, where they provide a service for their doctoral graduates. And if you, coming out with a doctorate, go to work anywhere, this placement service provides information about you. My first position was a teaching pastor of the headquarters church of the denomination I was a part of then, the Assemblies of God in Springfield, Missouri. Central Assembly in Springfield. I joined Jim Van Meter as teaching pastor. And Jim Van Meter had obtained from Stanford placement office this packet about Gene Scott, where I'd done my PhD. And he showed me a letter that I wasn't supposed to see, because this is supposed to be confidential and independent. I'm not supposed to know what's in that portfolio. Someone might have described me as a hybrid ape or something. And those who write are supposed to feel that no one will ever know what they say. But he showed me the letter. And the letter, in essence, said, probably one of the best compliments ever paid to me. And it was by Larry Thomas, my major prof, head of the American Philosophy of Education profs in that day. He said, don't make a mistake about Gene Scott. With the tenacious way in which he will argue or present a position that he's taken after some study, he absolutely, and the letter went on to say that one of the few students that he had, he absolutely does not get ego involved with the position he's taken. But he will argue based upon the facts. And if you take that as a dogmatic attitude, you will miss the fact that if in the midst of the argument, someone introduces a fact that he doesn't already have in his mix, like a computer, he will change instantly. It's as though it happens to him without any thought. And Larry was pretty analytical. I'd been his assistant, among other things, while I was at Stanford. And he says his whole mental frame will adjust automatically like a computer, and you'll still be arguing with him when he changed sides by the introduction of a fact he didn't know. That was grained into me. That's why I use the premise that I view teaching, and I don't ever make altar calls, because I don't try to coerce anybody into a commitment. I view teaching as turning lights on. You turn lights on in a room. If there's dust in the corner, I've said this to you many times, if there's dust in the corner, you see it. You are never going to be the same. You know it's there. Now you're going to either cover it up, turn your back on it, try to ignore it, sweep it out. If you need to slip out, it's okay. And you're going to either sweep it out, cover it up, turn the lights out, do something. Ignore it, live with it, fall in love with it, eat it, whatever. Once the light is on, you are never the same. Honest academics adjust to the light. And that is part of what high academic training is supposed to do for you. One of the reasons we have a media as sick as it is and as prejudicial and as one-sided as you have few true academicians, highly educated people sitting there delivering the news to us. They have no qualms about bending people's minds to prejudicial views in spite of their touted so-called objectivity. The Jesus Seminar gets contempt from me because these are true academicians in background, but they do not tell you that their product is the result of what in Latin we call a priori fixed positions. That's not the product of research. It's a stacked deck. They vote with little marbles, as I say. And they take a text at their meetings and they vote whether it's legitimate or not, whether it's genuine words of Jesus, for example. But before they vote, there's a criteria. If a miracle is mentioned or involved, black marble. If it quotes Old Testament text, which is interpretation, it's black marble out. If it's a lengthy story, because they've assumed these stories weren't written down until centuries later, which archaeology is blown aside, but they ignore that. If it's a lengthy story, they've assumed it has to be told word of mouth, and people can't remember a long story. So the words, if they're attached to a story, black ball. So the prodigal son is out, because that's too long a narrative for anybody to remember. Maybe for them. Jesus is the only preacher who can't quote Old Testament. If there's prophecy involved, that would be miraculous. So that must be blackballed. And they end up saying only 3% of Mark is legitimate. Because they blackballed all the... They don't tell you why. There's just academicians saying only this is legitimate. They haven't told you that they've kicked it out, not because they've researched documents whether or not it was there from the beginning. Likewise, Genesis. They approach Genesis with the same different group, but this is form criticism. Myth. Now, they separate the story. It's going to be myth if it's poetry. Poetic versus historic. Myth. What's a myth? A multiplicity of gods or angels. Can't have any angels around. Multiplicity of them. Can't even really think of Elohim as a multiplicity. Fairy tale. It's a myth if there's a multiplicity of gods or angels. It's fairy tale if there's talking animals. So the serpent makes Genesis 1 a fairy tale. I often say, you know, it's a miracle in the Bible if a man's ass talks. Today is commonplace. They're in pulpits all over America. But Balaam's ass or a bush talker. I've often told the fundamentalists that God talked through a smoking, burning bush, and that's what a cigar is, so get off my back. Legend. Patriarchal narratives where God is excessively prominent. You got that? Well, that's enough. Because that's not my message today. The point is, most people approach Genesis like they approach the resurrection. It can't be. So they find other explanations. I did my doctorate on Reinhold Niebuhr. I respect Reinhold Niebuhr as the greatest ethical theologian ever to live in America. But he was wrong. And he argued. Now, the neo-orthodox theologians were the leading liberals of the previous generation. Liberal theology taught that sin was ignorance, salvation was education, and the same message as Satan to Eve in the garden. With education, learning what's good and learning what's right, man is basically good, getting better, and to know is to have what will motivate you to do the good. Therefore, education becomes salvation. Reinhold Niebuhr, when he graduated seminary, was the speaker at the graduation. He gave a vintage liberal argument. He took a small church in Detroit, about 100 souls, through the days when Henry Ford, full of his prejudice against the Jews, his Nazi leanings, and his enslavement of human beings to the assembly line, which he covered with the mask of the five-day, $5 work week. And in that hypocrisy, where very educated men took advantage of the poor and uneducated, his theology began to shake, and he built a church in Detroit to over 1,000. Through the world wars that then came, when he saw the most educated nation in Europe bring the most terrible happenings ever to hit that continent. And he had to revise. He had to revise his viewpoint. Educated people can be evil. And he and Tillich and Barth and Brunner, the leading voices of neo-orthodoxy, return to the Bible. And in returning to the Bible, their theology was called neo or new orthodoxy. Because from the Bible, they gained and returned to the acceptance of the fact that man has a bent for evil. He has a nature that is inclined toward serving self, not God. Love of self, preeminent above all other expressions of love. And from that neo-orthodoxy, they return to the Bible. But he wouldn't go all the way when it comes to Genesis. In Genesis, he talks of myths. And he points out that God is beyond, and this is true, God is beyond our reasoning. And like artists on a limited dimensional canvas, try to portray the third dimension by lines that converge. That's not the way the house is, because the house has got straight lines. But you get third dimension by converging lines. This became his argument, and then he sought in the New Testament for the Apostle Paul, saying, as deceivers yet true, that artists sometimes deceive. They draw lines that are not true lines to communicate a third dimension not seen on the flat canvas. So they deceive us in order to give us a deeper, more real truth. Well, that gave him a fishing license. Now he concludes that God's trying to communicate to we dummies, and we are dumb by comparison to Him. And therefore, God is forever deceiving in His book to try to convey deeper and more profound thoughts. Thus, these are myths. They're not real truths. They're myths designed to deceive us if we take them literal. God didn't create. Though, strangely enough, he does believe God created on nothing. But everything else that followed, this serpent and the first man and woman and the fall and all the goings on in the garden and the hiding and the nakedness and covered with leaves and God killing an animal and giving them skins and all that followed, that's just myth to teach deeper truths. And we all have a fishing license to try to figure out what's the real truth that these crooked lines are conveying. An innate inability to simply accept. In the beginning, God. Period. Self-existent. Self-sufficient. Doesn't need us. We don't participate in His being or creation. He doesn't need us. This is why I've been on this crusade for 24 years to bring dignity back into giving. How contemptible. What an insult to God to see men across the world and women begging for God. Jesus, as I've told you, said to his disciples, don't take a scrip, which is a begging bag that heathen priests carried to beg money to lay at the feet of their gods. God doesn't need anything. C.S. Lewis, that I quote so often, said it best. God, to be God, has no needs. He's the creator. Out of nothing, he created it all. He's eternal. He was and is and forever will be. No beginnings, no end. How can that be? I don't know. The issue is, are we willing to accept something we can't capitalize, put beneath us in our reasoning, approve from our frame, and make serve us? It doesn't matter what you think or I think. And as I've said, I couldn't believe it until I settled the resurrection and then saw Jesus' quotes on the book of Genesis. And because I accepted his authority for his coming out of the grave, I then had to pay attention to his use of Genesis. And that brought me to this series, because I did an undergraduate major in geology. And there was a bishop in the Middle Ages, Usher, who calculated from genealogies that God created the earth in 7 days, 4004 B.C. Well, geology is irrefutable. Either God, and I might have done this if I'd been God. I mean, God could create it in 7 days and could have done it all 2,000 years ago, 4,000 years ago, or 6,000 years ago, 4004 B.C., and if I'd been God, I might have done it this way. Put all these things in these layers of rocks to keep people confused for centuries. I mean, if you're speaking, if you assume this, he's speaking and nothing becomes everything. He can put dead fossils in the rocks as well as fossil-free rocks if he's creating. Since a day is 1,000 years and he doesn't know time, that bothers me a lot because God's never on time with me. When he wants me to do something, I ain't ready. And when I'm ready, he don't want it. He's a lot like a woman. That woke you up. See? You don't care about all this highfalutin stuff. Now I'm down where you live. He had no time. He could let it roll through the eons of time with an evolutionary process. If God wanted to create via evolution, He can. If He wanted to start it all Genesis says is in the beginning, God created is the next word. God's God. Once you cross that hurdle, He could have belched or something else. And we have the Big Bang. That's what the scientists say, one theory. A Big Bang started, and I told you this last Sunday. Scientists down in Flagstaff, Arizona, began to calculate, and they were able to determine that the universe is expanding in its furthest reaches at 200 million miles an hour. And then some Bell scientists picked up sounds that they theorized were the remnants of the first Big Bang. And now if it's moving out, you go back to where it started, and they calculate how many hundred millions or billions of years back to the Big Bang. If God wanted to start it that way, He can. Elohim is plural. That's for emphasis in some cases, but also means plural. And there is, in the book of Hebrews, chapter 1, very clear words. Don't turn. You haven't got time. I'll just read it to you. Hebrews, this is not, Genesis 1:1 is not the only place that talks of the creation. Hebrews 1 names seven things that Jesus did. Starts out saying, God in divers times, that's past times, spoke unto us in divers ways. God, who at sundry times and divers manners spake in time past unto the fathers by the prophets, that's the way He talked, various ways in the old days, with angels, through bushes, on mountaintops, out of Shekinah presence, light, mouth of prophets, hath in these last days spoken unto us by His Son, the eternal Word who became the living Word, whom He hath appointed one, heir of all things, He's going to get it all eventually, by whom also He made the worlds. The agency by which the worlds were made, Jesus, the Christ, the Son. However you want to view the Trinity, that foci of God's nature was the speaking voice that spoke, as Hebrews 11 goes on to say, and not a thing became everything. In the beginning, God created. And then, verse 2. And this is where I was last Sunday, but I'm not finished on it. And the earth was without form and void. That word's kind of interesting. Tohu. And there's the vowel sound there, the vowel sound there. Tohu. Two consonants, two vowels. Tohu. The earth, King James says, was without form and void. This word translates waste. A waste and a desolation. The Hebrew word for was and the earth was. Without form, waste, and desolation. This verb can just as easily be translated became a waste and a desolation. In other words, it is not required in the beginning God created what did he create? The heaven and the earth. Period. In the beginning, God. He's there. People don't want to accept that. They want to remove that from their thinking. But the Bible declares it. In the beginning, God was there. And in the beginning, God was created. And in the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. When is that beginning? Well, I don't know. Neither is anybody else. And scientists come along and ridicule the Bible because, as I started saying earlier, I did an undergraduate major in geology. The evidence is there. Layers and layers. The erosion of mountains. The layering of layers of stone. The inclusion in those layers. Fossilized remains. Radioactive dating. Light that's reaching us from a source billions of years old. It took that long for the light to get here. This universe, the heavens and the earth, are older than any Adam and Eve and their descendants. So what? All the King James is doing is changing words around. The original, in the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. Period. Verse 2. And the earth became tohu, a waste. Now postulate a gap between Genesis 1:1 and Genesis 1:2. How long? I don't know. But long enough to encompass first creation and something causing it to become a waste. Now, there's evidence in the Bible. Why don't you write down some verses? If you're going to approach Genesis unwilling to accept it as historic record, you got a problem with the rest of the Bible. So read at your convenience a few. Let's take Mark 13:19. And next Sunday, I'll give you the basis of Christ's authority. Jesus is talking. And he's speaking prophetically that the Jesus seminar would kick out because he's talking about future days, talking about the time that will come of great tribulation. And he says in the 19th verse of Mark 13, "For in those days shall be affliction, such as was not from the beginning of the creation, which God created unto this time." That sounds to me like Jesus thinks God created. God was there, and God created. Let me give you another one. Matthew 19, verses 3 to 6. If you're going to accept the authority of Jesus, and I'll lay that down next Sunday, you've got to accept his view. 19, verses 3 to 6. Pharisees came unto him, tempting him with questions about man and wife. And he said, have you not read that he which made them at the beginning, made them male and female, remember I was on that when I listed to you last Sunday all of the beginnings that are in the book of Genesis, including the beginning of the family. When God looked at Adam and he didn't say, let's make another man for him. Not good for Adam to be alone, so let's get Adam number two. I don't judge anybody's behavior. I say send every sinner in town. But God, he's very creative. And he must have not thought that threesomes were that important. I mean, look over at Jesus and say, you know, it'd be good to watch it too. Let's get him two women. No, let's get him two men. The beginnings of the family are here. Lots of other beginnings. One I want to harp on every Sunday. God's act of grace to save fallen man, of which you and I are a part. The initiative starts with him. You have the beginning of his sovereign, to use theological terms, his sovereign action. His, what I call in the jawbreaker, prevenient grace. You don't find God. You're the luckiest people in the world if you have an interest. Once a light, like the spotlight of God's Word, finds you, the hound of heaven, as the poet calls it, somehow positioned you somewhere to hear your first true message. And something clicked. You may not understand it all, but something clicked. You're the luckiest people in the world. Because even here in Genesis, after their sin, they hid. And God came seeking them. Adam, where art thou? He starts the initiative. If you're one of those that spiritual things fall as water on a rock, dull, uninteresting, there are people all over Los Angeles that could not fathom sitting here for an hour listening to what I'm talking about. Assume 90% of it doesn't take. To those that are thirsty in the desert, you squeeze a drop and they're reaching for it with all their being. God alone creates the capacity to respond. God alone starts the initiative. God finds you. God is not lost, never has been. He's the seeker. But that's subsequent messages. I'm back to the beginning. Revelation 4:11. John the Revelator. The Bible assumes the Creator. Doesn't assume anything else. You don't even have a choice about it. Thou art worthy, O Lord, to receive glory and honor and power, for Thou hast created all things, and for Thy pleasure they are and were created. And we spent so much time in the Psalms. Let's go to Psalm 136. To those that want to somehow treat Genesis as myth and not fact, because it sort of embarrasses the sophisticated mind to think that God was out there and He spoke and nothing became everything. Psalm 136. Give thanks to the Lord, to Him that by wisdom made the heavens, for His love endureth forever. To Him that stretched out the earth above the waters, for His love endureth forever. To Him that made great lights, for His love endureth forever. The sun to rule by day, the moon and stars to rule by night. To Him that smote Egypt and their firstborn, brought Israel from among them. They don't even take a breath. The psalm just moves from what is clear history. Smiting Egypt's firstborn and bringing Israel out of Egypt from the creations of the worlds. It's not poetry for four verses and then history for the next verse. It's all history. In the beginning, God created. But Christians have been so intimidated with bad Bible scholars who are scientists and Bible scholars who know nothing about science to think that these two cannot be reconciled. As you think you can't prove the resurrection, you just got to believe it. You can prove the resurrection like any other historic fact. Produce a psychological reaction to those that expose themselves to the evidence. The creation is a fact. The problem has been the failure to recognize the gap between Genesis 1:1 and Genesis 1:2. Now, on what do we allege that? I gave you one verse last Sunday. Jeremiah. Jeremiah. And I've copied some pages out of my Hebrew Bible here. Write it down. Jeremiah 4:23. The literal reads, I beheld the earth, Haaretz, and lo, Wehini, without form, tohu. Same exact word, tohu. Same Hebrew word, tohu. Two vowel sound, tohu. Here's your two consonants, tohu. Same word. I beheld the earth, and it was without form. Go to Jeremiah 4:23. I went too fast last Sunday. I want you to go there with me. Am I boring you? The Bible gives its own clues. No prophecy of Scripture is a private interpretation. Jeremiah, verse 23. I beheld the earth, and lo, how many have it was in italics added by the translators? He just beheld the earth. Tohu. Without form, waste, and void, desolation. Exact same words as Genesis 1:2. Jeremiah sees this too. He introduces. And you've seen this many times in the Hebrew logic. Paul uses it a lot. In Greek, from which we get it, in English, we argue with the tautology. We say, if this, then that. If this, then that. The Hebrew rhetorical style is to state the conclusion first and then follow it, and when they're speaking Greek in the New Testament, Paul uses the little word gar all the time. For, and you know that when a verse starts with gar or for, it's explaining what preceded. Jeremiah starts out with his ejaculation out of his prophetic utterance because he's seeing something that is beyond his comprehension. And it's past tense. A happening that this prophet is seeing way back. Now, Jeremiah received wonderful prophecies, future and back. He was made trustee of the promises of God for both the tribes or the kingdoms, the northern and southern kingdom, prophesied their destruction and prophesied the 70 years imprisonment in Babylon. But he also had this past tense vision. I beheld the earth. They don't even bother with the verb there, because in the Genesis 1:2, it came. Now they add it here. We have a little, in the Greek Bible, we have a word supplied. And lo, it was without form and void, but it's not in Hebrew. He's just beholding the earth becoming waste and desolation. It's a past tense, But there's some interesting things about this past vision. I beheld the mountains. They trembled. The hills moved lightly. Now he's explaining the whole process of what he beheld producing tohu, waste and desolation. Before tohu, there were mountains. They trembled. Hills moved. This is the process that's causing what he just declared. I beheld the earth as tohu. I beheld, lo, there was no man. Now he's seeing an earth that's going to become tohu. There are mountains on it that are going to move, or he sees them moving, and yet there's no man on this earth. No Adam. No man. No Adam. And all the birds of the heavens were fled. Either an earth with no birds, if he's speaking poetically, but none of the rest of it's poetical. So there must have been birds of some kind. Fleeing as this cataclysm hits that's going to produce tohu. I beheld, and lo, the fruitful place was a wilderness. Apparently, this earth that had no man before it became tohu had fruitful places. Now they're going to become wilderness. And all the cities thereof. Interesting. King James translates cities. The Hebrew word simply means meeting place of intelligent beings. Not necessarily man. Meeting place of intelligent beings. Well, because King James translators couldn't conceive of any intelligent beings other than man, they call it, what is the meeting place of intelligent beings here? Cities. Dwelling places. But this earth that is beheld in past tense by Jeremiah, that's going to have mountains move, birds flee, and fruitful fields destroyed, and no man on the earth, but dwelling places and meeting places of some kind of intelligent being. Broken down, whole land shall be desolate. Yet will I not make a full end. Now that's very important. Because God could have spoke it back to nothingness. He didn't. He left it in this cataclysm that Jeremiah sees. He left it a waste and a desolation. Now, this is an enigmatic section of a past prophecy that fits in between Genesis 1:1, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, and Genesis 1:2, and the earth became a tohu, which is exactly what Jeremiah sees it become, tohu. Well, now, let's go to Isaiah. I didn't give you that last Sunday. Go to Isaiah 45:18. Isaiah is right in front of Jeremiah. For thus saith the Lord, for thus saith the Lord, I'm going to read it from the literal, that created, Bori, same word, a derivative of Bera, that only is used of God. Man can't create. Man can make, Asa. He can arrange things that already are. Even change things that already are. Only God creates. And the Hebrew is, without exception, God both creates and makes. Only God, Bera, creates. Because it's bringing something from nothing. For thus saith the Lord Yahweh, that created the heavens, Himself, God, Elohim, both names, that formed the earth and made it, not tohu. Now, I've told you this in the Greek, you remember, you have pistis, which is faith. That's faith. In the Greek, if you want to reverse something, you put A in front of it, apistis. Gnosis, that's the word for knowledge. Took the English letters. Agnostic, our word for I don't know. Gnosis, I know. Agnostic, don't know. In the Hebrew, you have a prefix like this. Remember when I was teaching on the prophecies of that minor prophet of the scattering of the northern tribes? Hosea was told to go marry a whore and have children by her because he's going, God's going to get their attention. They've been unfaithful to him, and nothing can get into the heart and emotion of someone close to home like unfaithfulness. And what God is saying to Israel is their idolatry as his wife is viewed by him as his wife becoming a whore. And he sends this poor young prophet just out of Bible school. First assignment. Nobody today would tolerate this. I can see him marching into the principal as he gets his diploma for preaching. What's your first assignment, son? Well, God spoke to me as I was on my knees praying last night. What did he tell you? Go marry a whore. Try that one. Some of you young preachers that listen to me, you try that. And have kids with her. God was going to, in dramatic form, try to get through to them how terrible their sins were of idolatry. And he says, you go marry this whore, and you have children by her. You name the first one Jezreel. Names meant something. Jezreel means scattering. And he says, because the seed of this union, your whoredom is going to produce the following. Your children are going to be scattered. And then he uses two words, Ami and Lo Ami. Ruhama and Lo Ruhama. Ami, Ruhama. In each case, your kids, one of them will be named Lo Ami, and the other will be named Lo Ruhama, because I will not give you mercy, and I will not be known as your God. Your kids are going to take on the characteristic, whereas up until now, you have been characterized with my treatment in such a way that anybody watching your history could tell I've given you mercy. And up until now, anyone watching your history could tell I have treated you as though you're my people and I'm your God. But now you're going to be Lo Ami and Lo Ruhama. Not my people, not getting mercy from me, not characterized with merciful acts from my hand, not characterized as a people led by me. And he takes the very same words that mean mercy and my people and puts Lo in front of it. Two letters in the Hebrew. Lo and a dash, Ami, Ruhama. Now we're in Isaiah. Same practice. I just want you to know that the Hebrew puts Lo in front of something to reverse it. Now read Isaiah. Isaiah, for thus saith the Lord that created the heavens, God himself that formed the earth and made it, he hath established it, he created it not in vain. The King James looking for new ways to translate. Well, you know what the Hebrew is? Not in vain. Well, let's just write it all out here. Lo Tutu. Totu. Lo totu. Not waste. Now say that in your mind with me as I say it. For thus saith the Lord that created the heavens himself, God that formed the earth and made it, he hath established it, not tohu. Not tohu. How do you be more direct? God created, Isaiah says, the earth, not tohu. Jeremiah saw it become tohu from a condition that had mountains that moved, birds that fled, meeting places of intelligent people, or intelligent beings, not any mankind on the earth, vegetation that was fruitful, all of that was there and it became a waste. Isaiah sees it and declares it. God created the earth, the heavens and the earth, not a waste. There's a gap. It became a waste in that cataclysm that Jeremiah saw. It became a waste is the declaration of Genesis 1-2. And in between, eons of time, however much time science needs to get its projections done. Well now, what might have caused this cataclysm? What could have gone on during these times immemorial? And I want to go back to my first comment and just say one thing. Somewhere way back, don't remember where, I read about a professor that said something that sounds real smart. He says, the most profound question ever to be asked is, why is there something instead of nothing? Now, doesn't that sound smart? And can't you see, it's like the story I've told you, the girl that came home where I was pastoring once and asked the question, the teacher was sort of upsetting her, asking, can God make a rock so big he can't move it? Because if he can make a rock so big he can't move it, then he's not all-powerful. And it bothered her. And she came to ask me, what can I say? I said, go back and tell him, hell yes, God can. But he's not that stupid. Would you, if you were God? I mean, to show off your power to whom? Make a rock so big you can't move it? Make it almost that big and then throw it on the people that ask the question. No, God ain't stupid. Now, it sounds so cute. Can God, or rather, the profoundest question is, why is there something instead of nothing? Nothing isn't. That's not a question. There's not a choice between something and nothing. Try to define nothing. Well, nothing is. And when you say nothing is, it becomes something. You follow me?
Yes, sir.
There ain't no such thing as nothing. There ain't a choice between nothing and something. That just sounds cute. Like all the BS you get from smart people who don't want to accept the fact God's there. You know, one of the reasons we don't want to believe in God being there is he's inescapable. You got to deal with him here or there, if he is. And he is. I go back to it from Jesus, but the more I stay in Genesis, the more it makes its own case. There isn't any conflict with science because God created not a waste, it became a waste and a desolation. Why? Well, I read for you last Sunday. I'll read it again quickly. God created Satan. He wasn't there in the beginning. In spite of the dualism concepts, the Bible says God created him. Where do you get that? Well, let me bore you again. Let's go to Isaiah 14. Hurry up. I'm in a hurry. How art thou fallen, verse 12, from heaven, O Lucifer, son of the morning? How art thou cut down to the ground, which didst weaken the nations? For thou said in thine heart, I will ascend into heaven. I will exalt my throne above the stars of God. I will sit also upon the mount of the congregation, the sides of the north. I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I will be like the Most High. Yet thou shalt be brought down to hell, is what God says. That's Lucifer. He wasn't always what he is now. His pride caused him to be cast down. Go to Ezekiel 28, verse 13. I ask you again, am I boring you? I'm about done. And I'll be ready for next Sunday. 28, verse 13. Thus saith the Lord, speaking of Satan, thou sealest up the sum, full of wisdom, perfect in beauty. Thou hast been in Eden, the garden of God. Every precious stone was thy covering, the sardius, topaz, the diamond, the beryl, the onyx, and the jasper, the sapphire, the emerald, the carbuncle, and gold. The workmanship of thy tablets and of thy pipes was prepared in thee in the day that thou wast created. Thou art the anointed, set apart, cherub that covereth, and I have set thee so. Thou wast upon the holy mountain of God. Thou hast walked up and down in the midst of the stones of fire. Thou wast perfect in thy ways from the day that thou wast created, till iniquity was found in thee. That's saying a lot of things in those two verses. Satan was created. He was designated with his pipes and tabrets, his musical ability built into him, form and shape I don't understand except the declarations of beauty, and he led the worship in the heavens of eternity. He was there from the day of his creation, and he was created to be the lead musician, song leader. Bible's full of people singing the praises of God around his throne. Satan was the music minister of heaven. We saw how he began to believe the response that the gift of music gives, and he says, why be second? I can be first. I could read abundant passages. I think I'll just quickly bring it to a close with one. Jesus said, Luke 10, verse 18. Go there. New Testament, Luke 10, verse 18. Luke 9 is pretty long, so you got to keep going. He had sent 70 disciples. You remember that story? He sent 70 disciples out. And they came back glowing and bragging and boasting. Why, we cast demons out of people. Even the demons were subject to us. And he cut into their bragging by saying, he said unto them, Well, the 70 returned again with joy, saying, Lord, even the devils are subject unto us through thy name. And he said unto them, I beheld, past tense, I beheld Satan as lightning fall from heaven. Now, the cataclysmic theory, which I adhere to and propose today, there is no doubt. This is not theory. God created the heavens and the earth, not a waste. A gap of time between Genesis 1:1 and 1:2 for all theories to fly around. Genesis 1:2, the earth became a waste and desolation, and Jeremiah sees that happening of cataclysm in detail. I propose from these other verses that declare, not theory, that before Satan fell, he was in Eden. We encounter him after Genesis 1:2, already the enemy of God, already fallen. These verses just read in Isaiah and Ezekiel have him in Eden before he fell. Eden's on earth. Have him on earth before he fell. Have him on earth getting lifted up in pride. And warring against God, and a third of heaven's angels joined the rebellion. There's a mysterious passage in Hebrews 2. Three Greek words, epilumbano, linked together, which is to bend, stoop down, with an intent to help, and actually help. And it says at the close of the second chapter of Hebrews, trying to emphasize to us, the descendants of Adam, how wonderful that God has provided a way of redeeming the failure that began in Adam. God did not bend down, epilumbano, did not bend down low to help fallen angels. But he did bend down low, epilumbano, to help fallen man. Something about this rebellion of Satan so turned God off. And there are those that try to argue the ultimate retention of all things, that God's grace will make him ultimately even redeem the devil. Not according to this book. He did not bend down to help Satan. That rebellion turned him off. And in that rebellion, the cities or meeting places were meeting places of Satan and other angelic beings that populated the earth in that pre-Genesis 1-2 following the original creation, not a waste. I have no trouble. I know the cartoon alley-oop. I remember I was reading a cartoon when the X-rayed his head and it was solid bone. And he had his pet dinosaur and rode around. Most of you are too young to remember those cartoons. Man couldn't deal with some of the animals that we find and continue to dig out. There is a suggestion in one of these passages, I've run out of time, where I'd give it to you in the Hebrew, that the earth reversed itself. And there's lots of evidence in geology for the possibility that the earth tilted on its axis at one time, which is why we find tropical vegetation underneath the ice in northern Siberia. And we have maps that show in Antarctica that was green vegetation. There have been possible tilts of the earth on its axis. The Siberian explosion of the great comet or meteorite that hit could knock the earth off of its fixed orbit pattern. One of these verses suggests that might have happened, bringing on the cataclysm. A cataclysm struck the earth, as described by Jeremiah, and it became a waste and desolation. And that was the consequence of Satan's rebellion. And as the scripture says, I just read, he didn't destroy it all the way. And suddenly the earth became a waste and desolation. And there was no light and no darkness. And it says, next, the Spirit of God. Go back to Genesis 1. The earth became a waste and a desolation. And darkness was upon the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters. How many centuries? How many eons of time? Here's God facing the rebellion of Satan. Jesus saw him cast down as lightning. Jeremiah sees the earth in its cataclysm. In Genesis 1-2, it becomes a waste, tohu, and desolation. The Spirit of God broods over the face of this deep. You know what follows is a recreative period. But the book of Ephesians says, and this is where I think it was happening, before the Spirit that was brooding over the face of the deep began to cooperate in the action that Hebrews describes as Jesus speaking forth the heavens and the earth as we now know them, that Spirit of God brooding over this darkness, the result of Satan's rebellion, conceived the plan of redemption. And exelexito, as the Greek word says in Ephesians. He, before he began to speak the worlds into existence, whispered your name, my name, and those of every generation, that he would bring forth to show off an eternity in the vacuum left by a third of the angels that followed Satan. He will replace them with Adam and the sons of Adam. Let us make Adam in our image. I want to set it in that frame before I go to the recreative period, that as this Spirit is brooding over a wasted earth resulting from the rebellion of Satan, and the creation that was not a waste had become a waste, God's creative energies are projecting the plan. He is going to speak the worlds into existence. But before that, as we taught in Ephesians, he chose out from among those he wouldn't choose, those in every generation in which he would plant the ability to respond to his word. You know how lucky you are in this vast picture? To be one of those that God put the little receiver in to respond to his transformer. You understand? I'll take up right here next Sunday. I'm going to leave a footnote of another story I read about faith. There was a disbeliever out on a hill, a rock climber, who slipped. And he's hanging about 1,000 feet from the ground because he caught hold of a little branch. He didn't believe in God. He's hanging there on that branch knowing it's just a matter of time. And he looks up and says, "Hey, is there anybody up there?" To his surprise, God spoke and said, "Yes. Can you help me?" "Yes. But you've got to let go of that branch." "Is there anybody else up there?" Now, next Sunday I'll give you a broader basis for letting go. But God is, and He can be trusted. And I hope there's something in your heart that says, "Thank you, Lord, for putting that spark in me that makes me interested in these things and capable of responding." But God may put you in a place where you've got to let go of the branch. Sooner or later, sooner in faith is better than later in doubt. And I rest my case. It's offering time. My Heavenly Father watches over me. I'll be looking at you this week. Hopefully this afternoon I'll be starting on, or tonight, either this afternoon or tonight, I'll be starting on Romans with you. I hope you'll be there watching. Voices of Faith, get back in your saddle, please. And good day.